Welcome back to The Present Stage, Conversations with Theater Writers. My name is Dan Rubens, and I'm a theater critic, composer, and arts nonprofit leader. My guest today is Jen Silverman, who has adapted August Strindberg's play, Creditors, for the first collaboration between Audible Theater and the New Theater Company Together. Jen Silverman joined me to talk about what it was like to take this relatively little-known Strindberg play from 1889, Creditors, and both pay incredibly close attention to the intentions of the original text while also adding their own lens, their own perspective, their own voice to the story. It's a really fascinating conversation, one of the ones that I think best dives into what it means to adapt any work, and I was really excited to get to dive in so dramaturgically into this text, both the Strindberg original and to Jen Silverman's adaptation. And this runs at the Audible Theater, the Minetta Lane Theater, through June 18th. So as you'll hear, there are some spoilers in this episode. About halfway through, we'll give a spoiler warning. So you can listen to half the episode, go see Creditors at the Minetta Lane Theater, and then come back and listen to the rest. Creditors, however, for those completely unfamiliar with the work, as I was before I saw the production recently, focuses on a trio of characters caught in a tense psychological drama. All that I'll tell you for now is that when the play opens, a young man, recently married, named Adi, is on vacation with his wife, the acclaimed novelist Tekla, who is off giving a reading of her work, and he has spent these last few nights talking to an older man who is incredibly curious about Adi and Tekla's marriage and has a lot to share and a lot of opinions to share about why this marriage will inevitably fall apart. And I don't want to say any more, but Jen Silverman, well, and I hope you'll follow us into this episode and into this really exciting conversation about what it means to take an old play and make it new again. So without further ado, here's Jen Silverman on their collaboration with August Strindberg on Creditors. Jen Silverman, welcome to The Present Stage.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. I wanted to start by talking about the way that the play is credited, which is Creditors by Jen Silverman after August Strindberg. And I was interested in talking about sort of the afterness of the play and what that means to you. I think in sort of art, when we talk about this painting is after Monet or whatever, where it's often sort of a copy or inspired by, but we're thinking of it just in terms of like the inspiration piece. But I was also curious about kind of the how we use after in normal conversation, like temporally, that it's Jen Silverman after August Strindberg, and there's something sort of essential about your adaptation happening in a world that takes place after his world. I'm just curious sort of how you thought about your relationship to him and to the play as you were working on it, and what that collaboration was like.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Jen Silverman 113 years after. Yeah. No, you know, it's interesting. I like that you're asking that, because that was something Ian Rickson and I talked about a lot from the beginning, in terms of how we wanted to engage with the original and then how to talk about that engagement. And I think I've done a number of plays that I would call very loose adaptations, or plays that were jumping off points. Like, I have a play which that is in the loosest conversation with the original Witch of Edmonton, a Jacobean play. And I've done some other plays, you know, in which I'm speaking to a play, but not necessarily adapting it, so to speak. And it felt important to me when Ian brought Creditors, the original Creditors, to me, it felt important that I wasn't just writing a play that was a response to it. I wanted to engage with the actual thing, and I wanted to get in there with August and sort of wrestle around and understand exactly what he was doing and why, and then understand what that would mean in this current world, and then understand the lens that I was bringing to that, which is a very specific lens, of course. And the after, the language of after sort of came, Ian introduced it to me actually, because initially we were thinking, how much am I going to depart? And if I depart fairly far, do we want a different title or do we want, it to be creditors by Jen Silverman, an adaptation of August Strindberg? And I said, no, I really want, I want August to come first. I want to stay close to the movements, the larger movements of his play and the characters and the dynamics and the structure. And then inside of that, I think there's more psychological texture and nuance to be mined for all of those characters. And I think if you really mine the richness of that psychological nuance, certain events will happen differently. And we could talk about that as we go. There are certain
Yeah,
choices I made
for
earlier.
sure.
So that is where the after came from, that I am trying to stay, I'm staying close to August, but I am coming after him.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if this was a play or a project that you had begun engaging with before this production came along. It sounds like it was brought to you. And I'm curious to hear sort of what your relationship with the play or Strindberg was before this, and sort of how this project came into your life.
Yeah, I had never, I will out myself here, I had never heard of or read Creditors before.
Nor had I, yeah.
I'd read in graduate school, they had us read Dream Play and Ghost Sonata. I almost confused those two. And I had read, ooh, I read Miss Julie while I was working on Creditors. I did not have a deep relationship with Strindberg prior to this, beyond sort of like the Touchstones. And then in December, Ian brought the play to me and said, like, read it and let's talk. And, if you were going to adapt it, what would you do? And I read it and I was, oh, I had so many mixed reactions to it. There's something about it that is captivating. It's also a very dark view of humanity and of intimate relations, and specifically of men and women. It's a much darker view of women than it is of men, but the men don't do too well in that play either, in terms of well-adjusted humanity, So parts of it really made me prickle, and that interested me. And then parts of it made me wonder about the size and shape of Strindberg's personal wound, and that interested me. And so yeah, so I sat down with Ian and we had a really fascinating conversation about the play and what we saw in it and what we saw that wasn't in it. And then from there I started working on it, and they Sonia Friedman got me, she's one of our producers. She got me, and I should say the company is called Together. It's Hugh Jackman, Sonia Friedman, and Ian Rickson formed it. And this and Hannah Moskowitz's play, Sexual Misconduct of the Middle Classes, are the two plays in rep that are sort of the launch of the company. So anyway, which is all to say, like, we've been figuring it all out as we go, and I've been really lucky to sort of participate in a company, like finding its mission and finding its footing with these plays. And so they got me this Swedish translation from I think a scholar at Harvard, I think, provided a sort of word for word translation of the original. And I read that alongside another the David Gregg adaptation. Yeah, and then and spent the winter sort of deep in reading and contemplation. I read the 100, no, 800 page biography by Michael Myers of Strindberg so I could really understand where and when he was when he wrote Creditors. There's a Sue Prideaux biography. I read that. I was really just trying to both steep myself in the language and also in the intention. Because with Strindberg, even the plays that depart from realism are still deeply steeped in the intention of the moment, for him.
And in terms of the language, did you think about the, or are there points in your version of the play that you think of as like acts of translation versus your own? Like how it sounds like you had a lot of copies of the script open in front of you. So I'm curious sort of whether you What I think is so cool about this version, your version of the play, is that, I mean, I didn't read it. I didn't read the Strindberg until after I saw your creditors. So I didn't even realize where the departure points were. But you can almost kind of feel, and not in a distracting way, but I think knowing that it's an old play, you can almost feel sort of alongside the tensions of the characters, sort of feel the tensions of the original and the adaptation, sort of in a way that you're kind of trying to. I was, I mean, maybe not all audiences, but I was trying to piece out, like, oh, could this be a departure moment? Could this have been in 1889? I'm just curious, sort of, whether you thought of those of moments where you were most closely hewing to the original as sort of like, I'm just going to translate this passage into my own language. And then depart from there, or did you think of it all as sort of like one continuous adaptive process?
Oh, that's yes. I love that you're referring to the tensions because there are the tensions, of course, between the characters, but there is also a very deliberate tension that we worked so hard to calibrate inside the language between high and low, between contemporary vernacular and more heightened, lyricized language. It felt to me very important that the tension was constantly present for the audience in my version, in my adaptation, because again, there was a version that was a much more contemporary and contemporarily rooted version in which that tension was not present. And that to me wouldn't have been an after so much, you
Yeah.
know? How to answer this? I in terms of how I thought of it up. So when I initially started working on it in December and January, I said to Ian, what I want to do is the following. And I'll tell you what it was, but I'll also say, and then as I started doing it, I realized that I was and I wasn't doing it. But what I had wanted to do was translate the emotional beats as opposed to the language necessarily. So I took the translation from our Swedish scholar, and I combed through it, and Ian calls them units. I would maybe call them like beats or but every moment in which we have an emotion present and then it shifts for a character shifts it. We are flirting and now we ask a question that is a suspicious question, and the question sends us into resentment from the person being asked the question and aggressive push from the person asking the question, right? So I created an emotional map, so to speak, of how Strindberg's flowed. And what I had thought I was going to do was stay completely faithful to that map, but find different ways, both psychologically and linguistically, to make that map happen. Because I will, and this is just my opinion, but I will say in the original, I think Strindberg excels at many, many things. For me, something he does not excel at is psychological depth in the characters, such that I understand where they're coming from and I believe them. I feel like a lot of times what Strindberg seems to be doing is archetype, is using a character as a mouthpiece for a philosophy or for his sort of deep-seated anger, frustration, loss, desire, right? And that these are not critiques, but you know, or criticisms, I should say. It is a critique. It's not a criticism, but just to say it's what it made me feel that what I could bring to the project was nuance and depth and the kinds of, you know, character layers that really just interest me in general. So I took that emotional map and I sat down, and I would say that I stayed about 70% faithful to my original desire to work that way. But I also discovered as I went that there were beats that were missing for me, that in which if a character is really operating from, you know, this moment of deep-seated insecurity and jealousy, which is cracking that person open into anger, and then the anger flares higher than it's flared before. Like I added a beat of violence, for example, that is not in the original, but that is sort of a moment in which two, I won't say who they are, but two characters have to really, you know, examine that everything they thought about themselves and each other is maybe not true if that moment of violence was capable of entering the room. So, and there were also places where, as I tracked the emotional map from a place of being really, really rooted in character, there were certain things I didn't believe in the original that I cut. There were certain where I thought, the characters would never not just say this, but they would never feel this. That's actually not where they are anymore. And I sort of restructured a little bit inside the original three movements, which I kept, which are three, essentially two-person scenes, but with different people, in this trio, different combinations of the trio, leading to a final moment in which all three people are present. And I kept the presence of the three in the final moment, but changed the ending substantially. And in some ways, perhaps my ending is in direct opposition to Strindberg's, though it is, I would say, opposition from a place of love.
Yeah, there are a few questions I want to ask you that may get a little, or rather, spoilery. So before I'm going to maybe give a spoiler warning before I ask them. So if people want to see the play and then come back to the episode, they can do so. But before I do that, I want to ask you about just the Audible and Together collaboration and what that looks like. Both is a two-part question. Part one, I just had Itamar Moses on the podcast talking about Dead Outlaw, and he was talking about how the structure of writing for Audible and knowing that the staging would eventually have to happen orally only really helped him find the show in a lot of ways, and that really was a useful limitation. So I'm curious about that, and then I'm also curious about what this, if you could talk more about what the together rehearsal process is and sort of how that is fresh and new and a new thing.
I should say I finally saw Dead Outlaw. I had been out of town when it had the Audible run, and it blew me away. I had loved it
Very
so
cool show.
much. Oh, yeah, I love that you had Itamar on. In terms of the first part of the question, so it's interesting because the mission of Together, I think, dovetails beautifully with Audible in the way that one of the things that Together is so interested in as a company is a real focus on language and a focus on actors' bodies on stage speaking language without necessarily a lot of spectacle that is coming from a design standpoint or coming from video or coming from, not to say that those things are not completely amazing because they are, but I think together, knowing that there is a landscape in which those things are being robustly explored, together is sort of interested in stripping it down. And so the focus on language, I think, in a way makes it easier, maybe not easy, but easier for those projects to translate quite well into Audible, because so much of the story is in the language. I will say, we're talking right now, Ian and I and Jeremy Blocker from Audible, about are there any slight shifts that we need to make to the creditor's script before it gets recorded, which is coming up in a few weeks. And we generally think that everything will play from an audio standpoint only, but except, not except, but there are a couple of moments that we're actually wondering about right now. And so we're in the middle of that conversation. Is it about Foley? Is it about a tweak to the dialogue? They're like the ending in particular, we're wondering, do we need a little bit of extra help there to let an audience person who's listening in on what's happening? And I don't know the answer to that. We're deep in that artistic conversation trying to figure it out.
That's very cool. In terms of Together's process, what has that looked like in the rehearsal room? I know that there's sort of, if I'm right, there's sort of like an ongoing rehearsal process through the performance calendar. Is that part of the structure?
Rehearsal is now done. And it was interesting. It was. I mean, God, we had so much fun in rehearsal. And also it was, Ian was directing both this and Sexual Misconduct. So our shows were in rep. I think the shows, unintentionally on my part, because I didn't know Hannah's Beautiful Play until later, the shows are really talking to each other, which I think, Sonia and Hugh and Ian were very aware of that when they chose both plays. And we're interested in mining that. And I think the two different companies have been sort of very supportive of each other in terms of actors. We also have the same design team, which is an incredible design team. And they've really helped think about how to create a container. The two plays have different sets, but the sort of ethos and value of those sets, and that, you know, is sort of held in a way that feels like you really are walking into a world and exploring two different chambers of that world, kind of. But I think I know Ian is staying until the end of the run, and so I think he is continuing to sort of talk to actors, and if they want to try something they haven't tried before, like, he's open to that, you know. So I think there, though rehearsal is done and though the script is done, there remains an interest in sort of fluidity and interrogating, because you learn so much when an audience comes in, you know. Like, you learn, I watched the first, I think, eight shows in a row, knowing, you know, knowing of course that the script was going to freeze much sooner than it normally would, and wanting to really learn as much as possible, but the audience has let me see it in a whole new way.
You mentioned earlier that added moment of violence, and I think if I'm right, sort of each of the three scenes has an added sort of physical element between the two characters. There's a hug in the first scene, there's the moment of violence in the second, and then there's a kiss in the third scene that like maybe that is sort of approached but maybe not realized in the Strindberg. And I'm curious. And then I would say that the actual ending of the play is sort of less, it's still a physical moment, but it's a less sort of heightened physical moment than in the original. So I'm curious sort of how you thought about, it feels like there are kind of these physical climaxes in each of the scenes that sort of the builds are like within each scene as opposed to like a huge explosion at the end in a sense.
Yes. Ooh, that's a very dramaturgical read, and I like it.
Yeah.
Everything that I say now is probably going to have spoilers in it, so
Sure.
heads
We can put the spoiler warning here. Go see Creditors, come back to this moment in the podcast once you have it.
But it's interesting. So I will say, part of my discovery digging in, and this is to sort of speak to the way physicality travels across the play, is I was interested in, and then Ian and Justice and Leah have joined me in that interest. In so the first scene in the original, of course, is this man interrogating this younger man about his marriage. And spoiler, we will learn by the end of the play that the older gentleman is Tekla's first husband. The younger gentleman is Tekla's now husband, her second husband. She left her first husband for the second husband. And the entire thrust of the play, I think, for Strindberg, is largely a revenge play. The older man has come back to sort of poison the younger man against their shared wife and ruin the marriage, so to speak. And that's fine. I mean, that's exciting. Revenge is always exciting. But I also thought the first husband is named Gustav, and I thought about Gustav's loneliness and his anguish and his depression, and that maybe he's come back. He's curious. I mean, Tekla, the wife, has just written a book about, you know, herself, but inevitably about him, because it is the story of her sort of liberation, her sexual liberation. And I became interested in a Gustav who is not just there for revenge. He thinks he's there for revenge, maybe, but across the course of this first scene with Adi, the husband, the new husband, who the Strindberg play calls Adolf, I thought, you know, is he sort of falling in love with Adi in a way? And that could be a platonic love. It could not be a platonic love, but there is something in this man, especially as played by Justice Smith, who's the most charming human on earth, but there is something in this man who, you know, that draws him and that compels him, and that even as he is trying to corrupt, so to speak, this man, you know, poison him in some way, like, are you, you know, who's your wife with? Who's she out with? What's she doing? You don't, I, do you know her? I'm not sure you know who you're actually married to. Even as he's trying to do all that, there is a way in which we've marked sort of throughout that first movement, a number of places in which he just, like, the intention changes. He can't help himself. He's drawn in, he's charmed, he's captivated. And actually, and so I say all this because Liev is the one who came up with the hug. And that sort of, and he said, what if in this moment, instead of taking this guy by the shoulders and being like, you need a strategy, what if I need to touch him first? What if I need to hug him? What if I'm hugging my younger self? But also, like, is this a moment where I'm captivated by him, and I don't know what that energy is, and I'm not a character who could name it, but I'm feeling something that is making me feel alive, you know. And that was so effective. It became for me a way of really understanding the shape of that scene and what's happening inside it. And then and the sort of how for me the entire play is about intimacy and the ways in which we navigate intimacy with other people, how we hurt them deeply sometimes without intending to, how we sometimes intend to hurt them deeply and instead we end up loving them, you know, like how we live next to the damage that has been inflicted on us, whether intentionally or unintentionally by those we love. So the map of physicality that you laid out, that in every way became part of my understanding of that dance of intimacy, and especially, you know, with and Maggie as well, who plays Tekla, was really sort of interested in that and mining the physicality in her scene, which is the second scene, between her and Justice or Addie.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I felt watching it and then was more aware of how you'd heightened it in reading the original was the sense that characters, especially Gustav, come in with an I mean, I think it's very clear in the second scene that Adi has this agenda of like taking Tekla to task for her behavior and then is sort of stymied in doing that in the way that he's intending to, and that's very clear in the original too. But I think in the first scene and the third scene, you've really heightened the sense that Gustav has this very clear revenge plot that he's, as you just said, sort of unable to realize because he sort of can't help himself in all of these different directions. And I think that is was very sort of like the part of the palpable tension is that even if you figured out what everyone's intention is, you don't know what that's gonna, how that's going to manifest. So it's sort of like a thrill, like you can sort of solve the mystery, but then the thriller is like the human nature is unpredictable.
Oh, I love that you're saying that. That, you know, I hadn't put it to myself that way entirely in my head. And as you're saying that, I'm realizing how smart that is. That's deeply in sort of you're speaking exactly to my intention, which is that they don't, we may or may not know why they're there.
Yeah.
They don't know why they're there. And they think they
Right.
know why they're there, and then it
Yeah.
changes. But I love that you sort of drew that or redrew that in terms of what is the thriller, you know, like I hadn't thought about that, that actually the thriller isn't, you know, is this, who is this man and what's he there to do? The thriller is what are any of these three people going to do? Because they are learning their own capacities across the play, which they didn't necessarily know at the top of the play.
Speaking of the sort of initial sort of mystery of the play is like, who's this old guy? Do you feel like you've identified the moment in Strindberg's original where the audience is supposed to figure it out, and is your moment different than that? Does that
The thing, right? Like when I first read the play, again, not knowing it, being completely uneducated, shockingly so, I had no idea. And I got to the third scene and she was like, "You're my ex-husband." And I was like, "What?" Like, didn't see it coming. But then once I saw it, of course I couldn't unsee it. And then when I read the play a second time, it was so obvious. From the beginning, it was obvious. And I thought, like, how did I miss this? So I thought, well, it's just me. I'm just like, you know. Other people are much smarter. They're going to get it immediately. And in the first few previews, I had some friends come in. I was interrogating them. Also, there were some like random people on the sidewalk that were talking about it. So I sort of like started interrogating them. Nobody figured it out. Of the people that I talked to, nobody figured out who Gustav was until part three. Somehow that still seemed to be an experience. And I know I talked to people later. Some people ended up clocking it earlier, you know, so it definitely is. It depends what you're looking for,
Yeah.
and probably your levels of suspicion and how many detective shows you watch on
Right.
Netflix that. But I was really interested, and I don't know what it means that I didn't see it coming in the original, and a number, the majority of people that I've talked to so far actually didn't figure it out until part three. So in that way, I think art structurally, mine and Strindberg's really map onto each other.
Yeah. I think my experience was, I think in the in like maybe 2/3 of the way through the first scene when Gustav begins sort of interrogating Adi about his how he feels about the first husband, I sort of caught on, and I but it's a really sort of sad, it wasn't like, oh no, I figured it out early. It's a really satisfying because I think once you figure that out, it's so clear that you can really enjoy the way that it unfolds. And I wasn't sort of concerned. I wasn't like ne didn't feel like I needed to like piece it together. It was just like, oh, I see what's happening, in a really satisfying way. And I think, I don't know, my ex and I don't know if you feel like there's a right or a specific goal of sort of when audiences happen, but I was surprised that there wasn't sort of like an audible reaction in the audible, so to speak, in the third scene at the sort of official reveal. It seemed like the audience had maybe sort of had there been like a ripple of understanding sort of leading up to that moment, so that there wasn't sort of a plurality of people sort of discovering it all at once, which I think is kind of nice for the audience, kind of to have their individual experience sort of framing that. And I talked to a couple of people after, and I feel like different people got it at sort of different moments, so I think that's cool.
It really, it feels like there has been a plurality of experience. And no, to your point, I think because I thought like, oh, this is so obvious, I'm just slow, I didn't necessarily build it so that there would be a single moment of reveal. I thought people would catch on either in the moment that you name, where he said he starts asking about the ex-husband in the book and like, oh, is he, you know, what's he like? Why'd she marry him? It's like a bad guy. All of that. Or the moment where Addie says to him, this late in the first part, who are you? You know, he's like, what do you mean, me? And Addie says, you know, we've been talking about me for the last 3 nights. Like, who are you? I had initially in rehearsal cut those lines because I said, that's the moment where everyone is going to go, oh my God, obviously it's Gustav. And Justice and Liev petitioned very strongly to put them back for a variety of reasons. You know, and it turned out they were right. I mean, we put those back in rehearsal because it really helped that moment emotionally and psychologically. And that was a moment for me where I thought, like, you know what? It actually really doesn't matter when or how an audience figures it out. I just need them to know it by the time the play ends. But this isn't actually a play about, like, ooh, guess who he was? It's a play about, you know, everything we just talked about. Like, who are we? Who am I? Who are we going to be to each other? Like, what happens to me when you become someone different? Like, that's what the play's about.
I'm curious sort of how you thought about stage directions in your script, because there aren't many in the original, and it felt like sometimes your interpretation of the characters is really coming out. It almost felt like if it wasn't sort of a fresh adaptation, it's almost like a director's notes on sort of interpreting the characters, where you say like an exposure to longing has made Gustav cruel, in one of the stage directions, which is a totally like clear reading of the original Strindberg, but it's also sort of part of how you understand the characters in your adaptation. So I'm curious sort of how you think about, I love asking people about sort of what stage directions are for or who they're for, and how you thought about them in kind of doing more character work between the lines than Strindberg did.
Yeah, I love stage directions. I think of them as sort of carrying out two functions. And the first is they are an emotional map of a character's journey. Because sometimes, because we, you know, yeah, so much happens in subtext, so much happens in the intention behind a line. I don't want to sort of quote unquote overnote an actor via the stage directions, but I do think stage directions are really important. To say this is the emotional map, this is the blueprint, this is a character who's coming from this place, and who's having these hinge realizations in these moments, you know, just to sort of show what I am hearing and seeing. And then I think of stage directions as a letter to designers and director, either the ones I'm working with or the ones like 20 years from now, to sort of see what I see. But I'll say, like, in rehearsal, when I'm in a production, especially a first or second one, I'm not married to stage directions. And I think sometimes I come in, and a design team, you know, will say, well, we just want to talk to you about this one stage direction because we thought it'd be a much better gesture if. And I'm always like, yes, please. Like, let's, you're the design. I'm not a designer. You know, I'm not a director. Like, I am a writer. And so for me, it's all negotiable in terms of inside of my collaborations, but it's helpful if people start with the map that is in my head, and then they can explain to me what a different version of that map is.
One of the other sort of big twists for me, I think, was sort of the revelation of who Tekla actually is, because the whole first scene is these two men describing her, and also Gustav trying to sort of get in Adi's head about who Tekla actually is. So we don't really meet her until we meet her. And I think the one of the sort of surprises of the play, more so in yours than in Strindberg's, although I think his Tekla is different than the way that they describe her also, but how hard she is working to communicate, and sort of how much work she's putting in to the relationship from what seems like a really caring point of perspective and point of view, which is so different from sort of how they both describe her in the first scene. So I'm curious just sort of how you, but I also was interested that you give her sort of a moment of cruelty that she doesn't have in the original, where she says to Adi, "Nobody thinks about you because you haven't done anything worth thinking about," and sort of is also adept at sort of psychologically hurting people, whether intentionally or not, or sort of understanding where people's vulnerabilities are in a way that maybe Strindberg's Tekla isn't as clearly adept in that way. So I'm curious just sort of how you thought about reintroducing Tekla both in the play in general and versus the original Tekla.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. This is something Maggie, who plays Tekla, Maggie and I have been joking about with each other because, so the first scene, you know, as you say, is like 38 minutes of two guys talking about this woman. And by the end of those 38 minutes, you're like, she must be a monster. And so when Maggie walks on stage and the audience is silent and they're judging her and they're like, she, and they're hostile. And she said, like, she's aware of it. She can feel that energy. And then, what's interesting is, and it's every different night to night, every audience, but at what point in that second movement do they start to go, wait a minute, this woman's charming, she's funny, she's a good communicator, she, you know, hang on a second, like I was sold a bill of goods. And Maggie's so charming as a person, as an actor, you know, and also the role Tekla, I think she's someone who's a bit larger than life. Like she has a real sense of humor. She has a vivacity. She has a personality. I was interested in, and Ian was very interested in with me, the sort of the ethos that she brings, which is the men are sort of like in their own ways, in different ways, but here are the rules. And well, Gustav is like, here are the rules. Here's how you're supposed to live. Adi is like, I feel lost. What are the rules? Someone tell me what the rules are. And then Tekla's like, I don't need your rules. I'm making my own. The whole point is to make your own. Like, I don't need anybody to tell me, you know. And of course, each of those perspectives has a benefit and a limitation. But out, you asked about sort of the moments of cruelty for Tekla. I don't think I wanted each of those characters to be. Well, to be human, right? To be as flawed as the next, and also to be capable of grace and generosity and tenderness, in their own ways, in ways that surprise them, and the opposite. And it felt to me, so again, I mean, we've passed the spoiler alert headline, but I'll wait, spoiler alert. So in the second movement, there is the moment of violence between Addie and Tekla. And it was really important to me that Tekla is the one who introduces the vocabulary of violence into that conversation and into the relationship, though Addie takes it farther, takes it too far. So they're fighting. She says what you the line that you quoted, that you've never nobody ever thinks about you because you've never done anything. He says, "I took you," and she says, "No, I took you," you know, and then has this sort of increasingly, the only word I can think of is emasculating, which is maybe the right word, actually, you know, monologue where she says that, you know, you had no courage, you were afraid to start our affair. I was the one who started the affair. You were terrified to touch me, terrified to look at me, but you liked it when I grabbed you by the throat and said, we're doing this. And I think the original gesture came from Maggie, actually. And then I became very interested in the gesture and wanted to push it farther. But she sort of like, she goes for his throat. It turns into a shove, but it is a violent physical gesture and it's hard. She does it hard. And then Addie in the gesture that we came in with my having written, he grabs her by the throat and he says, like this, you want me like this? And so for me, what that moment, and both, I mean, I have to say, Justice and Maggie have been so generous with each other in finding that moment in both committing to the intensity of it, but taking care of each other during that intensity and around that intensity and communicating. I mean, it's been really inspiring actually to watch them work on it. And I know something that Justice in particular wanted. He wanted to be able to do it without judging Adi. And he also said, it's very hard for me to engage in this moment of physical violence toward my wife and not judge this character. And so as we were interrogating that, I was saying, like, to me, this is not a moment of the headline for this isn't, you know, men are inherently abusive. It isn't, this is a moment of quote unquote domestic violence in which Tekla is a victim and now we're watching a victim navigate like what this violence is. Like those are valid things to interrogate, but that's not what we're doing. I said, I want to look at what happens when inside the pressure cooker of this supercharged marriage that is so passionate. We've seen them kissing prior to this. We've seen them, I mean, that's so high octane. Also, Adi is full of the poison that has been given to him throughout part one. So he's really trying to navigate these ideas of how am I respected in this marriage? Maybe I'm not. I don't think I am. I don't feel respected, you know? So with all of that on the table, what happens when Tekla introduces the idea of violence and Adi takes that idea, as we said, and goes too far with it. And then both of them have to look at each other and themselves very clearly and say, like, oh my God, like, how could you do that to me? I didn't know who you were. But also, I didn't know who I was. You know, each of them in different ways and to different degrees. It is important to say different degrees, but are participating in a violence that then requires them to look at themselves and each other very closely. Wait, did I answer your question? Now I've lost track of.
I do, speaking of spoilers, want to ask you about the ending, and which is, as you said, could be interpreted sort of in opposition to Strindberg's original. And I wonder if all of the changes that you talked about in the like the variations from the emotional beats that you had sort of initially mapped out, it feels almost like I feel like if you had just tacked your ending on to a direct translation of the play, it wouldn't have probably been, it wouldn't have felt sort of like a credible conclusion. But I think that it's almost like you were sort of like break, like making small fractures to like reset the bones along the way so that by the time we arrive at the ending, it doesn't feel like a break. It feels like where the play was heading. And I think I've been thinking of that and sort of reading the Strindberg alongside yours and a lot in terms of sort of how you're talking about the sort of masculinity and tenderness and control, where the a part of it is Adi choosing tenderness or choosing to embrace his tenderness that he's insecure about, and then directing it towards Gustav, in that sort of pivotal moment. But I'd love to hear you talk about sort of how you arrived at that ending and when you arrived at that ending and how you sort of had the guts to be like, I'm gonna flip the entire final moments of this play.
Yes. So we walked into rehearsal with that ending. And I was terrified of it and also felt that it was, I felt both strong in it and terrified of it. And so I don't even know where to begin. There's so much I want to say about the ending. So in the original, Gustav and Tekla kiss, or I don't know if they kiss in the original, but Gustav gets Tekla to sort of show that she's still attracted to him. Adolf in the original walks in and dies. End of story. And of a broken heart, presumably. I don't know. Drops dead. Tekla is on her knees grieving. Gustav says, poor thing, I guess she did still love him. Blackout curtain down, right? So when I read the original ending, I thought, like, I just cannot. For so many reasons, I cannot. And But I did think deeply about the ethos of that ending, where it was coming from. And it is a sort of culmination of Strindberg's argument, which is that women will destroy you, that marriage will destroy you, and that women will destroy you. And Tekla destroys Addie in front of our eyes. And there we go. I am oversimplifying, obviously, but essentially. And ours. You know, Ian and I talked a lot about this, and Ian gave me this language in a way that I was so inspired by. But we are essentially, Ian said, our play is essentially an argument for tenderness. In a deeply untender world, it is an argument for tenderness. And that galvanized me in a way, or let me see so clearly the map that we were trying to draw because it felt so right. And so in part one, Addie is made to feel that his innate tenderness and sensitivity makes him less of a man, less of a husband. It makes him a sucker. It makes him someone people can walk over. And he feels, or he is made to feel, that in order to grow up, he needs to be less tender. Then in part two, Tekla is essentially the one making the argument for tenderness, that Addie is trying so hard to have grown up and to be the kind of man he's supposed to be that he participates in violence, and then sort of has to see that in himself and address that in some way, or he's, I mean, address it. He's destabilized by it. He's destabilized by the whole thing, and he leaves. And then the third scene, we understand between Gustav and Tekla, Gustav still loves her. He has an immense amount of tenderness in him, despite his desire for revenge and his sort of armored, resentful, depressed, like all of the energies that are at war in him, there is also tenderness. And in our ending, by the end of the third part, Tekla says to Gustav, we don't have to be like this. Like, you know, the truth has finally come out, and his anger and his desire to hurt her, but also the way in which the desire to hurt her has hurt him, that he's hurting himself by hurting her, has come out. She said, we don't have to be like this. And he says, well, then tell me how we should be. And he starts to throw in her face this vision. Like, are you trying to say that we can all live together? Are you trying to say, what, you know, why don't we all live here together? We could go on vacation together. We could cook together. Like, I could wake up and you'd be making my coffee and Addie would be at the piano. Like, but as he tries to throw this vision sardonically in her face, what he is really doing is describing, for me, his deepest fantasy, I think, of tenderness, of not being alone, of being cared for, of being a participant in a kind of family unit that is not traditional, is not what he's come from, you know, but in which there is enough, there is sufficiency, there is not a scarcity, so of love and of tenderness and all. Anyway, so, and in describing this potential world, of course, he realizes that that's not possible for him. It's not going to be possible. He's describing a kind of intimacy that he's never going to have. And it triggers a panic attack. And so he is having trouble breathing, and he's sort of trying, and Tekla's trying to figure out what's going on with him, and he can't breathe, and he's, you know, sort of shutting down. And then Addie enters. And we'd really, especially in previews, discovered, I say previews, we had like, you know, we're still discovering. I don't know what the previews were. We had like a, you know, two shows before we really had the thing up on its feet. But we discovered in those early shows with audiences this moment where Addie enters, and then he has to, in front of our eyes, make a choice about the kind of reaction he's going to have, or essentially the kind of man he's going to be. That he could be angry, he could be vengeful, he could punch Gustav in the face, he could leave, he could walk away. And instead, he makes the choice to approach Gustav so carefully, to put a hand on his chest so tenderly, and to try to help him. And he says to him, breathe. And he's trying to help him breathe. And then the three of them, Tekla starts to help as well. And then the three of them, we end with the three of them sort of breathing together. As one organism almost. And for me, what you said about sort of breaking the bones of the play and resetting them, like that feels so much like what we were doing. Once I understood what that moment needed to be, how to work backward, how to make the seed sort of plant the seeds along the path so that they, once we get to that final blossoming, it feels both surprising and inevitable in some way, or not inevitable. I mean, we could have, any of us could choose something other than tenderness at any point. But what is so important to me in that moment is that Addie can find within himself the ability to choose tenderness and offer that generosity good to Gustav, and Gustav can accept it from him, which I think is also an act of tenderness, the ability to accept kindness in a vulnerable place, especially when you're in a vulnerable place. And so that was the thinking behind it, and it felt to me, I was, as I said at the beginning of this, I was terrified because it felt like such a big swing. It was a moment where I was not only diverging from Strindberg, I was in opposition to him. And I thought, like, I don't want to make this a moment of departure that is somehow about another playwright, about me coming along and trying to do something, capital letters. Like, I don't want it to feel like suddenly my voice is speaking. I want it to feel like a natural outgrowth of the journey these characters are on. And a moment in time, a suspended moment in time, that anything could happen afterward. They could choose not tenderness afterward, but a moment in time in which they are all experiencing something they've never experienced before. And the actors were, and Ian were so helpful, as was the design team, frankly. I mean, Isabella's lighting, the sounds that the Mikhail found, the sort of the heartbeat underneath it. Like, the more we built together, the more I remained terrified, but felt a strong conviction about what we were making and why we were making it.
And I was so surprised that that Gustav actually does allude to that idea of them all living together in the original, clearly intended to be voiced as a sort of mocking question. But I think what you just described is sort of taking, and what you've been describing this whole conversation has been sort of taking these moments that might not have that much psychological depth to them as Strindberg maybe is having the characters present them, but then sort of saying, what if he thinks more deeply about what he's just said, and sort of where would that lead him and where would that lead us? Which I think is such a, which is why I think this adaptation feels both so, I don't know if faithful is the right word, but so rooted in the original, but also so assured in the departure from it. Speaking of which, I have two more questions. One is just about some of the other sort of like plot point departures that I'm curious about. In the original, Addie and Tekla have a child together that they've left at home, and there's also an allusion to a lost child, I think, of Tekla and Gustav's. And I'm curious about that, and sort of why you left that behind. And also, Addie has crutches in the original. Which is a really specific thing that's not present in your version. So I'm curious about like those two specific shifts from the play that would have been sort of easy to just keep in, and I'm curious why you didn't.
Well, to start with the second one, it felt to me, Strindberg isn't here to defend himself, so I don't know what his intentions were, but it felt to me, with the choice to have Addie be physically disabled, that Strindberg was trying to equate a physical disability with an emotional disability. That Addie, so to speak, in Strindberg's eyes, the emotional disability being that Addie is, quote unquote, weak, sensitive, tender, things that, by the way, I don't think of as an emotional disability, because he did, because he, and I say this now having like read so many of his letters, I think he saw those qualities in himself and was frightened of them and wanted to kill them. He wanted to be strong in all of the ways that, and he, there was a kind of masculinity that he was reaching for in his own life, and it felt himself to not be achieving. And so I think that is the sort of ungenerous lens that he brings to the character of Adi slash in his Adolf, because he is being ungenerous to himself in those ways. So I didn't want to participate in that. I didn't want to trade in that. And I thought there's a version where Addie has a physical disability of some kind that is not supposed to read as also, as speaking to his emotional state. But I wanted to really think about why that would be and what I would be doing with it. And ultimately, it felt to me that I couldn't see sort of the value in going down that in the way that Strindberg had laid the path out. And then similarly for the question of the child, I read there was, I'm trying to remember now, there was one translation in which the child was dead, if I'm remembering correctly. And then there was a translation in which the child was alive. But in neither version did it, like Strindberg didn't really do anything with that. So I couldn't, again, I was trying to understand where that was coming from for him, and I couldn't find a foothold that felt either like I understood why he needed it or what we could do with it that would make it feel really alive. Like this, to me, this actually isn't a play sort of like about parenting. It isn't a play about, like the any family members that are outside that trio. It's about sort of like inside that trio, they sometimes parent and child each other, but I wanted to keep it really tight on those three people in that space.
And there's just the funny moment in the original where Gustav, in sort of discovering how gullible Addie is, said when Addie is saying like, "My child," people say like he looks like the first husband. He says, "Well, the children of a widow who marries again often show a likeness to her dead husband," which and he's like, "Oh my God," which is maybe a little bit too far. So I feel like you also reined in some of the like extreme gullibility. But my last question is, and I've sort of asked this question to as a final question on a bunch of episodes, but I want to contextualize it with a quote from the play, which is Gustav, in talking about Addie to Tekla, says, "I do appreciate hearing a man say now more than ever about art before he proceeds to realize that the world is still the catastrophe it always was. There's something endearing about how, in the face of an uncertain future, we just cling to more bad ideas." So my last question for you is, what is the role of theater in slowing down the apocalypse?
Oh God, I ask myself that question on the regular. It keeps me up late at night, frankly. Look. I am the child of scientists, so that informs my perspective. I think we need many things right now, among them, good science and facts and funding for good science. But the container that holds all of us and how we respond to the world and what we value is culture. And theater shapes culture. I think a lot of things shape culture. For me, theater is a really powerful tool that shapes my perspective on the world. When I see other plays by other people that make me see the world differently, that shapes how I move through it, what I value, what I become awake to, what I look for in myself. So is theater going to slow the apocalypse? I don't think anything can slow the apocalypse currently. You might find me in a more optimistic mood 3 years from now, but I doubt it. But maybe. But I think who we are on our way to the apocalypse is perhaps more important even than can the apocalypse be stopped?
When I think that idea is in keeping with what all that you've said about this play and finding the humanity of these people and the tenderness in these people, along the way. So thank you so much for this adaptation, for your aftering of Strindberg, and thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with Jen Silverman about Creditors, originally by August Strindberg. If you liked what you heard today, please share this episode with a friend. Please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss another episode. And please leave a 5-star rating or review so we can reach new listeners. You can follow along at The Present Stage on Instagram. Go see more theater. Have a great day. See you next time on The Present Stage.